Radio.
All right, we're back again with Dr. Howard Waitzkin. You're listening to Barrack Talk on DV Radio. Did I say it right?
Right.
And he has conducted an in-depth study. You're trying to bring awareness. So you're trying to reach as many active duty and veterans as possible.
Yeah, it's mainly active duty GIs that we focus on. The main thing that we're trying to do is to address the problems of accessing services that it would be useful both for mental and physical health services in the military. This is addressing what you've actually been dealing with too, which is that there's one suicide a day among active duty GIs and somewhere around 20 to 22 suicides a day among vets. My own involvement in this actually started during Vietnam. So I've been working, from the civilian side and as volunteers, trying to do various things to help active duty GIs in various military adventures that the United States gets involved in. And this latest one started about in 2004. So it was, basically after the Iraq War got started, after the Afghanistan War got started. And it's a collaboration with the GI Rights Hotline, which is a network of about 25 peace and faith-based organizations that have a 24-hour hotline that GIs, their families, vets can call in and get help with in a lot of different areas. And supposedly there's somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 calls a month that the GI Rights Hotline receives.
What's the name of the study you did?
It's called Military Personnel Who Use Health and Mental Health Services Outside the Military.
Right. And he's trying to reach. So, guys, listen up. And especially you guys that are active duty to what we're about to say. You guys are the ones that he's trying to reach. And I would assume this is like you're doing your best to help the military to figure out a way to reach these vets, to get them help. And you were just saying about how I'm reading part of the introduction on your website here on that study about the background and the conclusions and the results. I mean, so we were just talking about the crisis hotline. Is this also looking at what is available to active duty vets? Because I'm going to tell you right now, trying to reach those active duty vets is a major problem because they are, what's the right word, Bo? They are not blackballed, blacklisted. They get punished for reaching out for help.
Yeah, exactly. People who are actually in the active duty military have actually the worst access to medical care and mental health services, probably in any group in the society. And then when they try to reach out for civilian services, they're not covered. So it's a huge...
And they reach out to civilian services because they're trying to keep it private.
Exactly.
And not jeopardize their career. And I've talked to, me, Bo and I both talk to people on the back end of the page that reach out for help that are active duty and are really overly concerned, well, justifiably so, concerned about it getting back to their chain of command that they're dealing with depression or suicidal ideation or those excesses that we're talking about. And they know they need help, but they can get their clearances yanked. They can get pulled off a deployment. They can have their weapon taken away. There's so many things.
Yeah, no, that's right. Actually, when we get referrals, people are often in really bad shape. The study showed that about 72% of the roughly 250 people who were in the study had major depression, and actually 48%, half, had suicidal ideation when they were seeking help. And when we start with folks, they're often so depressed and burned out with exactly the situation you're talking about. They know that the problems are there. They try to seek help and they get punished for it. That they're almost incommunicado. It's very hard for people to speak. Sometimes they're homicidal as well as suicidal. And what happens, this is actually some of the most gratifying work that I've been involved with as a doctor, because within minutes, when people realize that the person on the other end of the phone only cares about them, doesn't care about the needs of the command, the whole thing starts changing. So, you know, knock on wood, in the time we've been doing this, we don't know of a single suicide among our clients. There was one death that we know of a guy that was shot and killed by the cops because they weren't adequately trained to deal with mental
health. That's a whole nother thing, too.
Yeah, to deal with mental health problems. But we've had amazingly good results, actually, by doing not that much, just opening up a situation where there are doctors, social workers, psychologists, and counselors who volunteer our time just to provide a kind of very focused services and also the documentation that people need in terms of letters to help them get their needs met, either inside or outside the military.
Now, this, Dr. Howard, we're speaking to Dr. Howard Waitzkin. You and other fellow docs put out an article. We're talking about the article of military medicine. Now, did the military approach you to conduct this study? And if not, how is this study going to be used? Is the military going to get access? Are they going to heed it? Or what do you hope to accomplish with this article? Obviously, besides less suicides, I know that.
Right. So this was actually quite a process. It was published in Military Medicine, which is the official journal of the military in terms of federally employed doctors. And actually, the editor is the former dean of the Uniformed Services University. So we were kind of shocked that we got a very positive response and actually great peer reviews and everything, even though everything we do is outside the military and we don't collaborate in any way directly with the military. We receive no support whatsoever from the military. Our main contact with the military in terms of both the command and health professionals and mental health professionals is that when we have clients who need help and aren't getting it, or who are getting punished for seeking help, or are a threat either to their own life or to others or both, we actually contact the mental health and physical health professionals and the command to make sure that people are getting taken care of or at least aren't punished for seeking help. And that's the main relationship we have with the military.
Well, the military really does need guidance and training on how to handle that. And I think it's such a... It shouldn't be taboo, but it is. And it's just like everything else in the military with integration and women and all this. This is another area where it needs to start at the top and come on down with an iron fist about opening these doors for these folks. Like in your introduction, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere for the last almost 20 years, you know?
I guess I want to say a couple things about that. First, the policy at the top is very supportive, officially.
Right, exactly.
The problem is, it's BS. It's not actually implemented on the ground.
They know that. They know, I understand what you're saying. It is coming from the top, but those unit commanders, the captains, first sergeants, platoon sergeants, and all that, have their own unofficial policies.
Yeah, exactly. So, and what happens is that the professionals, the doctors, the psychiatrists, the psychologists who work in the military actually have what we call double agency. They're double agents. They're supposed to adhere to the Hippocratic Oath, which puts the patient's welfare above anything else. But by just because of the job they have, they actually are violating the Hippocratic Oath a lot of the time, because, as you pointed out, there's no confidentiality. They have to think of both the patient's needs and the command's needs. And so there's an inherent conflict. And this is why GIs and, to some extent, vets get so burned out and get suicidal, because...
And they don't trust anybody.
They get double messages. Well, we're here to help you, but we're not actually going
to
help you.
We want you to open up, and as soon as you do, that's the biggest complaint. They cannot talk to anybody truthfully.
That's right. And the other thing I just want to emphasize is that, you know, these wars are a little different from prior wars like World War II. Starting at about the Korean War, we actually don't have a clear story about why we're doing this. You know, we're told that it's for terrorism prevention and so forth. But as GIs know when they're on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, it has actually very little to do with that. It has mostly to do with making money, either access to oil or other forms of construction, you know, destroying things and reconstructing it, getting a bunch of corporations involved to sell a bunch of arms and planes and so forth. So the point I'm trying to make here is that there is a moral injury that's involved, because there isn't a clear story that justifies why we're suffering and why we're inflicting suffering on others.
Why we're going. No, and I'll agree with you on that. You made a good point, and that resonates with me. Like you said, up until World War II in Korea, we had a clear objective to unconditional surrender, to annihilate the enemy and this and that. And now we're involved in nation building and all that. And that's a good point. And it just seems like there's no end in sight. A lot of these kids have had, I don't know what your stats show, but I know that I just ran into another vet that's just retired after 20 years. He's got over 8-9 deployments.
That's right. It's more than any human being can tolerate, actually, in my opinion. And the other, you know, big problem with the voluntary nature of military service now, without a draft, as opposed to what we were dealing with in Vietnam, it's like all under the radar. The vast majority of the population goes about their lives without any experience of what's going on. You know, members of Congress, you know, there's very rarely a member of Congress who actually has a kid that's involved in any of this. And of course, the same goes true for the presidential administration. So so we have a situation where this really needs to have a lot of it really needs to be addressed.
So you are listening to Barrett's Talk right here on DVRadio.net. We've got Dr. Howard Waitzkin. He'd done a research on PTSD for the health services outside the military for active duty soldiers. Now, Howard, do you mind me asking who you've done this for? And after you answer that real quickly, why? Why did you do this? What makes the group, you and the other doctors, why did you guys want to do this for the veterans and as you mentioned, active duty soldiers, PTSD? I mean, there's a lot of people out there doing it. Why you guys?
Okay, so we're called the Civilian Medical Resources Network, and we're a group of volunteers.
I didn't know that. See?
There's only one person in the whole group who's paid part-time, who's the coordinator, who's at Fort Hood, who's a woman who's comes from a military family, Laura Muncy. Her partner was an Iraq vet, real active in Iraq Vets Against the War. We're all doing it because it's a huge problem, and we're trying to do the best we can to help.
Understand that. Now, I know that you guys took active duty personnel, I'm presuming, and done this study. Okay. Were they from all over the country? Were they from other countries?
How did you find your test subjects?
Exactly.
Okay, so as I said at the beginning, these are referrals from the GI Rights Hotline. So
there you go. That one answered that one, Bo.
So people call into the GI Rights Hotline, which is an 800 number, and for the part of those people who have mental or physical health problems that aren't being addressed adequately, The GI Rights Hotline counselor can refer them to us.
Okay. And then you guys help them as like any other doc or shrink would, correct?
Right. I mean, we do it by remote control, in that most of it's over phone or Skype.
That's what we do here.
Okay.
Because people are, you know, we have clients in Afghanistan. We've had clients in Iraq. We've had clients at secret places in Poland and other countries. And then also near or at bases that are very remote and hard to get help in the civilian sector from doctors and psychologists and so forth.
So it is possible for you active duty people listening, it is possible for somebody who is active duty to get help and not jeopardize if you try. So here is a success, because everybody I talk to says it's impossible, but here are the ones you're working with where they got good, great referrals and dealt with you. So it is possible. And I think the focus, would it be a fair assessment to say that more access to private facilities and services would be a benefit to the active duty soldiers and military members?
Right. So, you know, part of the volunteers are actually some of our previous clients, okay, and people who weren't our clients but were in the military previously. Like one of our main intake people who's working as basically a community health worker now with us is a 20-year Marine vet. So these are people with a lot of experience. And where we're coming from is that there's that group of volunteers and then a group of basically people who object to militarism and war, of which I'm one. I'm a conscientious objector from the Vietnam era. And I've always done military support work as part of that.
So you're still serving, though, the way I see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of what to do, which is the other question you asked, what we're arguing for is that because of this conflict that military professionals have, and that soldiers often have the experience of feeling screwed if they seek help, we want there to be access to civilian doctors and mental health workers when the GIs feel the need for it. And that's what's not possible for active duty GIs currently, but it should be possible. Now, what we're not arguing for is privatization of the VA. Right. So I want to make that clear.
Okay, that's good. No, what I'm interested in, at what point, I see both sides of the coin, being that, you know, when I was in too, I'll play devil's advocate, that there are some individuals that need serious help when they do reach out. And obviously, you know, when there are those big red flags that, you know, that somebody can not only get the soldier or the military member help, but also, you know, not put them in a situation. But I think the biggest thing that, like, we're saying here is there is a serious problem within the military community of active duty, so military members, of access.
Right.
Now, your study. Let's talk some more about your study. So what else? There's a lot of numbers and this and that. What else did you discover when doing this study that you think our listeners should know about that you found?
Okay, so there were very high rates of depression, you know, over 70%, PTSD about 60%, suicidal ideation about 50%, and anxiety, PTSD, and that group of problems, which was about 35%. There was also a lot of substance use, and then a huge amount of problems having to do with family members who were sick, who needed help. People were super stressed because they couldn't get home. They weren't granted leave. Dying parents or recently died parents, they can't get leave. So there's that kind of problem too. And we've tried our best to relate to all of that. The amazing thing is that these numbers are about five times higher than the surveys of active duty GIs that the military does, which usually finds, you know, like 20% depressed, 15% with PTSD, etc. So what's happening here is this huge gap between reality, people who are in the military, need help, don't get help, seek it out, you know, as best they can in the civilian sector, and what the military reports through their service. So even though the military acknowledges the problem at the highest levels, the data that they have basically don't communicate the problem.
Or it doesn't back up the true thing. I'm looking at a lot of the categories and fear of reprisal. We've talked a lot about that. We've talked about mistrust of command. Obviously, insufficient non-responsive services, but there's also, I don't know how much of that was a factor, but the deception and the pre-existing disorders where you talk about in your study where some of the people that are having major issues with mental health problems disclosed it to their recruiters.
Absolutely. Now, this was one of the really amazing findings that we had that we weren't aware of, actually, which is that recruiters not only lie, which we were.
No, come on. Recruiters don't.
So that's pretty common knowledge. It's terrible.
No, that's a given.
But a lot of our clients were actually told by their recruiters not to reveal their mental health problems.
If you want to get in, that's how they do it. So, if the individual wants to get in and the recruiter thinks, it's not a big deal. That's so a lot of power to put in the recruiters.
Exactly. So like between 20 and 30% of our clients actually had major mental health problems before they entered the military, and they were encouraged to basically lie about that at the time of recruitment. And then they get in the military and they're completely inadequate services to deal with that.
Which causes more drain on resources for those who have.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's also part of the huge suicide rate that exists because, you know, the part of people who commit suicide were perfectly fine before they entered the military and had major trauma and, you know, commit suicide for that reason. But a portion of the people who commit suicide or are suicidal actually were that way before they entered the military, too, and just haven't gotten the help that they needed.
So 30% of the people that we're talking about in the study had pre-existing.
Yeah.
And we could – that's a big number. I mean, there's something else.
And it's even bigger because, frankly, those are the people who say that they do.
I understand what you're saying.
DB6, if I could really quick, I'm glad you brought that up, Howard, because I know, and I'm sure it's true for DB6, and I know it's true for myself and Google and Recoil and a lot of our other shows host, that when we redeployed coming back from overseas, your commander and everybody, they're telling you, yeah, tell them that if you've got problems, tell them you've got problems. But I noticed that when they're asking you these questions, and I have friends that this happened to, they'll say, do you have the nightmares and all that? And they'll say yes, but the look that they give you, and then they'll ask you again, it's not telling you, hey, you can't say that or you're going to get kicked out or you're not going to get help. But it's along those lines. Is that something that you're hoping this study is going to help to actually bring to the surface? Like that, look, these people are having these problems. They've had pre-existing before they entered. They're having problems when they come back or what have you. You need to identify and actually help it. Is that something you're hoping this study actually does?
Yeah, because people are either told that they will get screwed if they admit it and seek help.
Yes.
Or they're given this kind of message that there's something wrong with them if they're feeling that way.
Right.
Because they should be strong and be able to suck it up. So the bottom line here is that the normal reaction to these military experiences is trauma. How can you be in combat or even in some of the stuff that goes on outside of combat and not get traumatized?
Right.
But the communication is that there's something in the human mind that, like strength, that means that strong people should just suppress normal reactions,
right,
which is really pathological.
Well, I hate to bring up, you know, bad times, but it's gone on for years, from everything from before JFK was assassinated to the Las Vegas shooter. And every time you hear it on the news, they had no signs of mental illness. But now, all of a sudden, they're mentally ill and unstable. Is that something that you think is contributing to some of these outbursts that might be happening?
Oh, yeah. No, this happens not only in the military.
Right.
The whole society gets the message that that if you are distressed because of real conditions in your life, that there's something wrong with you rather than the conditions.
Right.
No, you would agree that that's perfectly normal, and it's a normal reaction to be stressed or have anxiety.
Exactly. So, you know, we have a colleague who's a psychologist who has this idea about pathological normality. And he argues that the so-called normal conditions of society, which has to do with, you know, violence, pollution, job insecurity, food insecurity, et cetera, that's what's pathological. And the idea that that's somehow normal is pathological. And when people get normal reactions to those and are considered mentally ill, that's the problem.
All right, we're back. I'm with Dr. Howard Waitzkin, who has got an article out, Military Medicine. You're listening to Barracks Talk on DV Radio. Real quick, just one other thing that we also have to, that's not in, I don't see it on your study, I'm looking at it now, is, maybe I'm wrong, but one of the biggest hurdles to getting help or admitting you need help is within our own. Even when I was active duty, peer pressure is a motherfucker. And I can say that because it's our show. Admitting you have a weakness or that you need help amongst peers, you can be shamed, looked down upon, viewed as weak, you know. But that's publicly. But I do know of, in my unit, in that we used to drink and talk openly about stuff, but to say, hey guys, you know, hey, that last deployment kicked my ass, I think I'm gonna have to go in for a tune-up, that doesn't fly too well amongst our peers when you're in, you know, like you just said, there's this you have to have this appearance of being the almighty type. If you're a squad leader, platoon sergeant, first sergeant, sergeant major, or the colonel, or the captain, or the lieutenant, God help us, those LTs. You have to have this appearance of being invincible.
You know, the Marine that I mentioned before, who's one of our most active volunteers now, his name's Ron Manz. I'd like you to invite you to get him on the show. He has like 20 years of really hard military experience everywhere in the world. He feels so strongly about what you just said that he's organizing events in the community on mental health.
That's awesome. Well, we definitely, when we get on the back end of the show, we can talk more about that, obviously. And just don't know how much, we didn't do a lot in the pre-show, but Bo and I would like to let you know that as far as what you guys are doing, our organization on the main Facebook page, the one with the over a million followers, the early stages of that page when I first created it, the amount of vets and active duty reaching out for help that were suicidal was so overwhelming to myself that I was ready to shut the page down. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I found a solution, and I'm not trained. I'm sorry, but I'll talk to somebody, but I am not trained. I would never, ever want that responsibility of somebody's life in my hands that's suicidal. So we partnered up with Battle in Distress, and they're an organization that is fighting against the epidemic of veteran suicide and active duty suicide. So we have that. We have people on a page that are trained as first responders, and then they triage them, assess them, and push them to the appropriate agency. But what you're doing and your volunteers, I'd love to talk to you about that later, about maybe trying to partner up or use some of the services you have. So
well, we need help in terms of more purpose. In fact, because, you know, there are limited people who feel that they have the time and energy to do this as volunteers.
It's a high burnout, right?
And we don't want to apply for money from the military or some of the, you know, foundations that are basically have conflicts of interest in this area. So I would love to partner. What we're trying to do, because of the problems you just mentioned, is to actually train some of our intake workers like Ron so that they can function like community health workers or promotores and feel that they are, you know, more or less comfortable and have the training to deal with this without
them. I can put you in touch with my guys. I don't have any involvement in the training or anything of that. I'm just the head of the whole organization. They do an outstanding job with recruitment and then training and working that page. You're in the trenches down there. But it's awesome. Like I said, I told Bo, I don't want to beat into, you know, everybody has their part to do. And I do. I respect what you're trying to do to help our men and women. And, you know, there's many ways to serve, whether you go in the military or not. There's many ways to serve your country and this and that. And I do. I applaud you.
I applaud you, too.
What is your take and thoughts on, and this is for the female, but it's on MST?
Well, what do you mean?
Well, in your study, I think I saw it in there. How many female in your group, the female vets or active duty? What are the numbers on that?
Military sexual trauma.
Yes.
So there are about 12% of the active duty military who are women. 18% of our clients are women, and about 2/3 of those have had military sexual trauma. About 2% of our male clients have had military sexual trauma in the military.
And I know I think it's becoming more accepted, but still there are all those naysayers out there say that's impossible, but I'm not in that camp. I believe that it goes both ways.
You bet. And some of the cases that we have of men who have had military sexual trauma in the military are some of the most needy, most traumatized people that we've encountered, actually. So, huge challenge. Again, there's all this hypocrisy and bullshit, frankly, at the highest levels of the military about military sexual trauma. So, you know, it's forbidden to harass people, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that on the ground, it still happens, like every day.
You have men and women together at almost every level of the military now. I'm not saying you have to accept it, but it's going to happen. How much of it happens is up to how the military, you know, trains. And we didn't have any of that. I got out in 92, and I cannot remember any of the stuff they're talking about now of ever we having to do it, all the sharp briefings and this and that. But again, the military's is doing an almost seemingly impossible job over the last, like you said, two decades. Well, since 2003, 2002, one.
Well, it was 9/11.
Yeah, so, you know. All right.
There are actually a number of people who kind of focus on military sexual trauma as therapists. And then there are vets and even some active duty GIs who have made this kind of a cause, like one of the Veterans for Peace vets that we collaborate with is a woman who had military sexual trauma. And, you know, she's devoting a large part of her life to trying to make it clear that this is happening, the extent that it's happening, to try to get the military to initiate policies to actually prevent it instead of being hypocritical about it and to help the people who are affected by it.
Here's another big category that a lot of our listeners, whether you're active duty or not, it deals with. And it never leaves you, I don't think. I don't know how you can ever get rid of it. It's guilt. Clients experience or anticipate guilt about killing in multiple narratives. Guilt generates emotional distress. He puts suicide. And then there's the guilt of those who, can't redeploy, or the guilt that somebody else was killed and not them. There's a lot. We deal with that on a day in, day out basis on the page. People, that's a big one.
No, it's huge. It's actually one of the most frequent categories of problems that our clients have. And as you say, it's about both guilt about what they've done, what folks have done, and especially when they're civilians, women, and children that they've either killed or injured, often unintentionally, but sometimes ordered to do that, generating huge guilt, and also the guilt of having your comrades killed and instead of you, which is like a lifelong trauma, exactly as you say. So this, again, is one of the things that contributes to suicide, and it's one of the things that, that we try to focus on. There are some approaches to that that can be helpful. But the main thing I want to emphasize in this is prevention. One of the things in public health that we really focus on is how can you prevent health and mental health problems rather than to try to put band-aids on them once they happen. And in my mind, many of us who are involved in this, it's really militarism that needs to be addressed. Going to war for fake reasons, which is the name of the game now for the military-industrial complex. So preventing mental health, physical health problems by preventing war needs to be the priority. And of course, the government and the corporations that they're affiliated with are going in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, that may be the case and probably is the case, but there will always be those that this problem, no matter what, will never go away. I have my thoughts on, we're talking about, the circumstances will always, they'll never change. They'll always be there. The circumstances of why people are having all these issues will always be there. And I think part of it is, how do you help them? How do you even prevent it? Well, if there was a better way of not decompressing when you come back to deployment, if there were policies instituted that as a unit had to participate in, not going to a therapist or whatever, but maybe those tools of things that are good mental health things. I'll give you an example. One of the things I deal with when I was working with another nonprofit here in town, we used to have weekly meetings with different war groups, the Vietnam era vets, the Persian Gulf era vets, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then we had an open meeting. And I used to tell these kids that come through the door that, you got a lot to talk about in this night. You need to come to group. Think of it like this, as a tune-up. You go in once a week, take your medicine, you get to talk to other vets that have been there, done that, and conquered some of their demons and this, that. And then you're good for a week. And you do that until you think you don't need it anymore. That's one. There's quite a few, other than, shoving pills down everybody's throat. And one other thing, before I forget, we've talked about the military as a whole. What I'm really curious, when we talked about the tough guy, the invincibility complex, it must be really bad for officers that are active duty. If it's hard for an enlisted service member to ask for help, I can only imagine what it will do to an officer who seeks out help.
Some of our worst cases have been officers. Actually, one of the worst cases was a chaplain. So, what you're talking about is true. Could I address a couple of the other things you mentioned?
Sure.
Drugs, and there'll always be this kind of situation. Drugs. What's happened is that people are going into deployment and combat drugged.
I know. I can't believe that.
It's actually like the as far as we can tell, it's the majority of GIs going on deployment were drugged, and then they go into battle, into combat, drugged, and the drugs that they're taking interact with each other, and some of them actually increase the risk of suicide, especially in combination. So this is like polypharmacy that's contributing to the problem. So instead of dealing with the root causes, we give people drugs to basically calm them down and accept the trauma that they have. So I can't agree with you more. It's a huge...
My blood pressure just shot up because I went out. Let's just say, you know what, I run this farm for homeless vets here, and I've had at one point a vet come through the door, and he's a zombie. He's a zombie, and then it's a box of meds, and they had him on half a dozen different psychiatric meds, and this person wasn't even alive. He was a zombie. And it's just the solution for everything is and I explained to my guys, you know, the veterans, when I'm in process, look, you control what the doc does. A psych doctor, when you tell them you have problems, 90% of a good majority of them, the way to fix it is with a pill. You can fix things without pills too. You can learn to accept that, like you said earlier in the interview, that, you know, it's normal for all the crazy crap you've been in your life and where you've been. What you're feeling is normal. Now, what you do about that, this is what you do, you know. So there's a lot. I mean, there are so many different things that could have more interviews on. I really do believe that. And you're more than welcome to come back. And we can take one issue of all the – there are so many things that I think the average person, when they look at your article, or what is this, a report? What would you classify this as? A study?
It's a research article in military medicine.
To each one as a whole, for somebody like me, wow. But piece by piece, you know, could really hit home.
So one other thing you said, Mike, really bothered me, which is, it'll always be that way.
Yes.
Okay, so it'll always be that way if we let it be that. And the thing that I find so weird now is that in the United States, the vast majority of the population is feeling like this is the way it's going to be, and this is the way it has been, and this is the way it'll always be. So you have hundreds of millions of people unhappy who can change things if they just got motivated.
Absolutely.
Okay, so... And war is one of them. I think we all have to stop and ask, like, why are we doing this?
No, absolutely. My brain can only handle so much, so I picked a fight, and I put 100% of that fight into the veteran homelessness issue. But I do have my very strong opinions, and put me in charge. It like I said, the only way I keep my sanity is I picked off my battle, and you know, I'm either pessimistic or an ultra realist of things. But for right or wrong, you're absolutely right. You know, the power do have the people to change things, but it's a long, long, long other topic, which goes to that starts right from the very beginning of upbringing and schools and just citizenship.
I really admire the farming aspect of what you're doing. And that, you know, in fact is here in the Midwest, we live actually in like Podunkville in rural Illinois on the Rock River. And, I was approached by a group of young people, I'm talking in their early 20s and high school students. And this is a large group in a rural, basically rural area, who are fed up with having to be told that you should go to school and you can get jobs, when the reality is that the economy is so bad that people actually go into the military not because they want to fight terrorists or anything like that, but first because they can't get a job, and second because they can't get an education. And they're told by the recruiters, you can get those things if you go into the military. And then they go in, of course, and it's very...
There are those.
But the point I'm trying to make is that these folks are committed to living their lives in a different way. And that's happening all over the country and, in fact, all over the world.
And let me just be clear, because I know people are listening. We're talking about the DV farm. It's a farm in title. It's a rehab. We do very little farming here. It's more with animal therapy, and we'll have a small garden this year. But the guys work on projects 3 days a week, and then the other days are focused with meetings and therapy and AA and getting putting the broken pieces of their life back together. But that's another with the farm title. It's a misnomer. We're not out there gardening and planting crops. We're cutting down trees and tapping back in. We're rebuilding their lives. You know, their self-respect, their self-esteem. Showing them that they're their best. We teach them how to be their best advocate on their behalf and give them the tools to go out there. I only take the problem children, the rejects, the ones that everybody else has given up on. So those are the ones. Yeah, we
Six. Yeah. If you don't mind, if I could comment really or ask,
brings us back on track.
Yeah, but I think I seen it in chat just a minute ago, Howard, but I know we have a lot of active duty members that listen. I know we have family members that take care of them, that are retired, and we have a lot of veterans that may want to help. If someone's listening right now that does want to help and participate in something in the future with your, group, is there a way that they could do that, or do they have to be near you guys?
No, and you know, our volunteers are all over the country and actually even in Europe. The best thing to do would be for people to get in touch with me either by email, which is probably most efficient, or by phone, and it's on our website.
Which we'll drop the link into on the live show then, and probably attach it in the podcast format.
Yeah, if you could, Howard, do you mind saying what your website is really quick so everybody can hear it?
CivilianMedicalResources.net.
Okay. Yeah, Six, do you want to ask anything else? Or
No, what I was going to say, for those who are still, and let's keep this, for those that are listening and want to learn more and follow more on this conversation, go to the DV page, Dysfunctional Veterans on Facebook. Check out the... something with Dr. Howard Weinstein. I don't know what the topic will be, but you new guys who are regular followers of the damn radio station and stuff in the page know how to find the video. And listen, assholes, you know, with the whole point of us doing this interview with the doc here and then why he did all this work is there is a problem out there for you active duty fuckers. And there's no excuse not to get help. When there's a will, there's a way. If you're dealing with issues and this and that, and you don't want to go through the normal chain of command and their SOPs and all that, you still can get help. You can log into the DV forum site, which is dvbarracks.com. You can talk there. Doc, do you have a way that if they really need help and they don't want to go through normal channels, are you still taking referrals or is there anonymous?
Their website is girightshotline.org.
That's like GIRIGHTS
hotline.org.
Okay.
And there's an 877 number on the hotline, that's staffed a lot of the time during the week. And if not, you can leave a message and they'll give you a call back.
Well, that's been great. Again,
we actually would rather get referrals through the GI Rights hotline. Because when people have mental or physical health problems, it's usually in the context of a lot of other problems that the GI Rights hotline can help with.
Right. They'll triage them and see. That's what was my point. There's many and the point of why we're telling you guys this is there, you know, a lot of resources out there. there's a lot of resources out there. And as always, you know, you can reach out on the page too, and we'll do the same thing. We'll point you in the right direction.
And the GI Rights hotline actually can use help also.
So they're looking for volunteers.
So it'd be wonderful if people, it's hard to do it when you're in the military, but when you're a vet, despite all the problems, it's possible to learn some fairly simple things to be very helpful when GIs or vets call in for this number.
Bo?
Yeah, I'm going to have all the links that Howard mentioned, that you mentioned, down below in the podcast and as well on the YouTube channel.
So, guys, Doctor, it's been a pleasure having you on, and I can anticipate that we're going to have you on again in the future. And thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Very, very, very important work that you're doing also.
Thank you, Howard. Take you care. Just heard Howard Waitskin, who done a study for researching PTSD right here on Barrett's Talk on DVRadio.net.
DVRadio.